I think I must have been only 9 or 10 years old the first time it was my privilege to go out with the band on Remembrance Day. We used to stand wearing our poppies with what seemed to be thousands and thousands of ex-servicemen, wearing their caps, proudly displaying their medals, looking rather solemn as they remembered lost comrades and friends from all those years before, sharing a few hymns together before the last post, all the flags dipped with the exception of the Salvation Army banner, and then would follow the rousing tune of the reveille, and heads would lift, flags would rise, chests would be thrust forward, and we would all march away from the cenotaph until next year. Having played with Salvation Army bands now for over 40 years, one thing has certainly changed. What looked like all those thousands has got smaller in number every year. And now, the number of veterans who were really there during World War II is barely a handful. But every year is the same. Respect, reverence, remembrance for the sacrifices made by so many to protect the world's freedom. Over the years, of course, I've had some tremendous conversation with some of my Salvationist comrades, people who really were there. I've had the pleasure of interviewing them, of writing about them. I remember being thrilled hearing the story of my friend Ron Griffiths, who only recently was promoted to glory himself, but for many years during World War II was a prisoner of war. I also remember sharing the story of Norman Cotton, who was actually one of the young men in the Paras who parachuted behind enemy lines into France just a few days before the D-Day landings. The story that I wrote is fictional, but I felt it would be nice to share it if anyone wanted to hear, particularly at this time of year when we hold services of remembrance and dwell for a few moments on those who gave so much. Preceding the story are just a few songs and tunes that we associate with this time of the year that army bands will be proudly playing today all round the world on Remembrance Sunday. May God bless you.
Thank you.
They shall not grow old, as we that are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn. At the going down of the sun, and in the morning, we will remember.
Thank you.
Grandad's desk. Even now, it's hard to take it all in somehow. He was just Grandad, you know? The little man who'd been there all my life, with his old-fashioned glasses and false teeth. How I used to hate seeing him without them. How he used to put him in a glass of water every night with a pink fizzy tablet. He was never a huggy Grandad. Not like Nana Gwen at all that way. She used to give cuddles all the time and would pull you up onto her lap and ruffle your hair. Grandad used to shake my hand like a gentleman. And he would slightly bow his head to you so you could see the light reflect off his shiny comb-back hair that smelled of Brill Cream. That was my Grandad, who walked with a stick and drove his little metro at 20 miles an hour and had barley sugar sweets that he used to tell me off for crunching. Suck it, he'd shout at me. You'll break your teeth. I remember before his knee got too sore, he would kick a ball about with me on the back lawn when he took a break from digging his garden and straightening his runner bean poles. And then, while I did some keepy-ups, he would tell me about all the players he used to watch for City and how they were so much better than now. Barney Smith, we said, could head the ball so hard the laces of the ball used to leave a dent on his forehead. And Johnny Fox, who dribbled down the wing as if the ball was glued to his foot. But I know he still watched what he called the modern rubbish as well. Because every time it came on, I could see him peeking round the side of the newspaper, and he didn't used to turn the page for the whole of Match of the Day. But I know what you'll be saying. Why am I telling you all this? Well, I'm sad to say that Grandad died last month. He'd been poorly for a while and had been so sad since Nana Gwen died last year. I'll never forget him crying at her graveside on the day of the funeral. To be honest, there's just something, what's the word, like creepy about seeing your granddad cry. You just don't expect it. Anyway, he went into hospital for tests and never come back out. By the time he died, we'd all had time to get used to the idea, and anyway, the little old wrinkled man in the hospital bed wasn't really him anymore. I prefer to keep my memories of him as he was before he went into hospital. My mum and dad and his sister Auntie Mary started going through all Grandad's things last week, bagging up his clothes for the charity shop, throwing away half a dozen empty bottles of aftershave and shampoo and about 20 lots of talcum powder. What is that stuff for anyway? It's just smelly white powder that I always used to find on the bathroom floor. And I was helping my dad to do Grandad's desk. We found envelopes with old photos and cards in, some going back over 80 years. There was a picture of my dad and his sister when they were little, him with a posh suit, short velvet pants and diggy bow, and her in a little knitted bonnet, looking for all the world like a doll. There were birth certificates, his and Nana's wedding certificate from 1947. Nana Gwen's death certificate was in there too. I never knew her middle name was Maud, neither did my dad. And there was a cutting from the newspaper with an obituary for my granddad's dad, who'd once been the mayor, apparently. I think Dad cried a bit when he saw the birth certificate of his own little brother Norman, who would have been my uncle if his death certificate hadn't been dated only 2 days after his birth one. But Dad coughed and turned his head away for a moment, and then we carried on sorting. We put letters in one box file, photos in another, and so on until there was just one big brown envelope left, right at the back, almost as if it was hidden. Inside, we found several sheets of yellowing foolscap paper, all covered in Grandad's neat handwriting. I'd certainly never seen so much of his writing in one place. Usually just a few words on a birthday card and a nice little verse written into the Bible he gave me many years ago when I was 7. Let no man despise thy youth. 1 Timothy 4:12. And a few lines underneath telling me to keep God's word close to my heart throughout my life. Even Dad had never seen so much of Grandad's writing as we could see on these carefully folded pages. As soon as we began to read the first few lines, it became clear to us both that Grandad had never, ever spoken about this part of his life. And that's why, even weeks later now, it still seems so unreal. This is what Grandad had written, down to the last comma and full stop. We'd all hoped and prayed since the day I left school that the war would be over before I was called up. Not that the war had passed our town by, of course. We were home to all sorts of evacuees. Little ragamuffin children with dollies, box suitcases and gas masks, sent by trains and buses from London and other big cities to the more peaceful country towns. Two of them had lived with us for a couple of years. Ellie and Dot were like two extra little sisters to go with our Mary. Like her, they didn't like football or mud, so they were no use to me except for a bit of good-natured teasing. They'd arrived with pale grey faces and snotty noses, but the country air and plenty of sunshine had given them rosy cheeks and a glowing complexion. I had worked for a few different shopkeepers on the high street in the last couple of years, hopping on and off my bike with basketful of newspapers or bread, or dragging heavy bundles of pressed bedsheets from Draycott's laundry up to the cottage hospital for a few bob to supplement the family income. And I had a happy enough life, I suppose. I certainly had no inkling of what was coming, that's for sure. The night before I turned 17, I read a few pages of an old Dandy Monster comic I'd had for Christmas a couple of years before, and had fallen asleep remembering the lines from Corinthians we'd learned in Sunday school about putting away childish things. I was almost a man. I could be called up any time now. I might have been already. Had I been lucky, or was I just a tad jealous of my peers that had been? I could also smell the aromas of bacon. I discovered the next day that all the extra ironing Mum had been doing had been for old Farmer Turner in exchange for a few precious eggs that she'd needed to make me a birthday cake. It was also why we'd been forced to suffer the bitter saccharin tablets in our tea for the past few weeks. Mum had been hoarding our sugar rations. I awoke to a card from Mum and Dad, one from Mary, and a hand-drawn one by Dot and Ellie with a daisy on the front, and my call-up. Strange how the whole world changed in that one instant. It was as though St. Paul himself had whacked me over the head with the big leather-bound Bible from the church lectern, in an attempt to drum into my thick skull the lesson I'd glibly passed over the night before. Dad sat quietly reading the paper. Mum was dabbing tears away with her dainty little pink-bordered hanky. Within a few days, I was immersed in some basic training with hundreds of other equally bemused lads from all over. There were northerners, southerners, and plenty of other Welsh boys from the towns and villages that weren't blessed with coal mines and the protection against call-ups that working down them meant. I palled up with two of them who shared the same hut as me. Tony Taff Jenkins and Di Rees, who reckoned he could have signed for Newport County if things had been different. Taff and Di helped me through those early weeks of PT and rifle ranges. We shared jokes, made up stories about girls back at home. At least I was making them up, having never even thought about holding hands with a girl, let alone what they were claiming. And sharing woodbines. No loss to me. I hated the foul things, but everyone else at the camp smoked. It was something else to do, and no one wanted to look like a sissy. It was April 1944, of course. What turned out to be 2 months before D-Day. None of us knew a thing, of course, but as the weeks went by, it became a little bit obvious that something big was in the air. The American General Eisenhower had been in England since January, we later discovered, and plans for the Normandy landings had been discussed at top level for a year or so. I can assure you, nobody discussed them with us poor beggars. By the middle of May, we, along with more men than I'd ever seen in my life, had been moved down to the south coast and were waiting, nervously, yet quite excitedly too, for more news and instructions. There were us Brits, Yanks, Canadians. The whole of our 3rd Infantry Division was dwarfed by the Engineers and the 27th Armoured Brigade. A sweaty, frightened mixture of men, all clouded in fag smoke and supping endless gallons of stewed tea. And each of us wondering if, when we left these shores, we would ever return. We all know now, with the benefit of hindsight, the details of Operation Overlord, the D-Day landings, as history books would no doubt one day record them. How Monty and Eisenhower sent 175,000 men across the English Channel to follow up the successful bombing campaigns that had so far thwarted any serious German invasion of England. We were, of course, part of the landings on Sword Beach, the most easterly of the landings. 30,000 of us, I'm told. It's very strange, but sometimes that doesn't sound as many as I'd thought. But at others, we'd felt so alone, we could have doubted that there were a tenth of that number. The whole thing was almost called off, we hear now. Again, sometimes I wish it had been. But most of the time, I suppose I'm glad we did what we did. All the time remembering those who, unlike me, did not make it back home and through to VE Day barely a year later. God rest them. The landings had to be on a night with a full moon, and Eisenhower left the final go-ahead almost to the last minute. We hear now that some of the Germans had even been given leave of their defensive posts, not believing that we would be able to proceed in the bad weather. We crowded into boats, and I tell you, the sea was like a mill pond, barely a wave. There was not a sound save for the rumble of the engines, and no one dared speak. But even our breathing seemed to echo and amplify each man's fear. Oh, we were scared, all right. Enough of the step up a lip, old chap, malarkey, thank you very much. Many a sob was stifled with a cough that night as we sailed to an unknown destiny. Thank God I was still with Taff and Di at that point. It just gave me enough of a grasp on reality to be able to maintain an ounce of sanity, to see my friends' wide-eyed faces in the watery moonlight. I can see them now. They could have been 8-year-old boys as I looked at them on that boat, sitting rigid, braving the chilly night air. At least, were it not for the dirt and stubble on their waxy, anxious faces. As dawn broke, we were still miles from the French coast. The daylight brought with it increased movement among the men, cigarettes being lit, even the odd short, whispered conversation. but I couldn't have spoken if my life depended on it. My tongue was dry and cleaved to the top of my mouth as if with glue. My lips were dry and salty. As we neared land, we could hear the sound of both rifles and heavy guns. The Germans had an Atlantic wall of coastal defences and used thousands of mines as well to help prevent us landing. By the time we reached the shore, the carnage could already be seen. Bodies lay dead or dying at the water's edge, their blood turning the sea an unforgettable crimson. I've heard it said that we at Sword Beach got the easy landing, that the Americans at Omaha and Utah beaches had to literally climb over ranks of dead and dying comrades even to reach the shore and be mown down there by machine guns. I don't even want to imagine that. What I saw was bad enough to haunt me to my dying day. Taff and I made it to a place of safety an hour or so later. We'd lost contact with Di on the beach, and it was almost a month before we learned that he'd barely made it out of the boat before a mine blew him to kingdom come. God rest him. Poor Di Reese, who never would play for Newport County. 28,845 men landed on Sword that day, one of whom was me. Including the other beaches as well, it was 156,000 of us. If we thought, however, that that was to be the end of our work for the day, how wrong we were. With only a few radios having made it ashore with us and the Germans doing all they could to jam frequencies, it was several hours before we even knew in which direction we had to go in order to meet up with the Canadians who'd landed at Juneau. And no sooner had we found them and smiled in joy and relief together for a few moments than the panzers arrived and hell itself descended again in a ferocity of fire and evil one could never even try to describe adequately. That this counterattack was one of so very few in the whole day, maybe, just maybe, my colleagues and I deserve in history to lose the tag of being the ones who landed on the easy beach. We fought all evening until the German 716th Infantry Division was virtually destroyed. There was no desire, need, or inclination to celebrate, though. As twilight gave way to darkness, our scattered ranks began to reassemble. Wounded were being given some respite, and the dead gathered together. As I helped in this latter task, by the light of the moon, I saw, towards a thicket of small trees, my friend Taff Jenkins. He was attempting to lift the body of a taller colleague, and I ran the 20 yards or so to his side. He managed a smile and a, "Hello, buddy," obviously as glad to see me as I was to discover him alive. As we hoisted the body onto our shoulders and turned to return to camp, a cloud moved across the moon, and we struggled for a moment to adjust our eyes to the resultant deeper darkness. As we did, a stranded and injured German infantryman limped out from behind the thicket. I reacted before Taff and the infantryman, and I stood face to face, both of us with our guns drawn, about 5 yards apart, barrel to barrel. As Taff turned and saw this, he was startled and literally jumped. When people say someone jumped out of their skin, I could only presume they mean like this. If an actor tried to replicate the action, it'd be comical. But there was nothing to laugh about in our situation. The German reacted to Taff by turning away from me and firing on Taff, killing him instantly. My training and instinct led to me doing the same to the young German. Lying dead there together, I could imagine the two being brothers. In the pale, veiled moonlight, they looked so alike. Suddenly, I was on the ground too, between the two bodies. The shock of the last few moments had robbed me of all sense of pain, and it took me some time to realise that, as I had fired, so had my opponent. Why is it that as soon as such an injury is discovered, the pain arrives? For suddenly, it was though the whole of my leg was on fire. I tell you, if I had access to a saw at that moment, I would unhesitatingly have removed the whole limb. It was another 20 minutes or so before I managed to attract the attention of a Canadian soldier who helped me back to base, and I was treated there for a few days and returned home to hospital in England within a week. My war was over. I felt compelled some time later to board a train down to South Wales and the delightful resort of Porthcawl, where I was able to meet Mr. and Mrs. Hugh Jenkins and their beautiful daughter Gwendolyn. We cried and laughed together long into the evening as we recalled tales of their dear son Anthony, my butty, who'd been so near yet so very far from safety himself, just a few months before, on a moonlit June night outside Cannes. That Gwendolyn and I fell in love, almost at first sight, I have to say, is a fitting tribute to my friendship with Taff, and it was the proudest day of my life when we stood together before God last week and were married. May he bless us with many happy years together. Amen. On the back of the final sheet of foolscap was another short note. It read simply, "Having committed these lines to paper, I will now put them away and never read them again. Nor, I vow, shall I ever speak of the events herein found. In time, may God allow some of the more graphic memories that still haunt my sleep to fade." And it was signed, Arthur G. Williams, July 1947. My granddad, my hero. And to think, I used to laugh at him going on about his sore knee. Author's note. Actually, it was a result of discussing with Lewis his English coursework from college. I said that if he wrote his, I would do one as well, and we could compare. But as usual, I got caught up in writing and went a bit over the top. This is entirely a work of fiction, but based on internet research I did during the writing concerning the D-Day landings. The characters my family will find interesting, for they're very much based on my paternal grandparents. Grandad was not at Normandy. Indeed, he was the chief of the fire service in Cardiff during World War II, but his name was Arthur George, and my Nana was indeed Gwendolyn Maud, and we really only discovered her middle name upon her death. Dad has no sister called Mary or Ellie, although he had a sister Dorothy. He did also have a brother Norman, who died in infancy. Grandad really did grow runner beans, wear glasses, walk with a stick. But he had bad hips, not knees, and that caused by arthritis, not bullets. He did watch football on TV, but not boxing, although he most certainly did watch the boxing around the side of his newspaper.